P1? The other man grasped Riskin's hand. The private's hand was cold and clammy. He was short, looked oriental, and to be on the verge of going into shock.
Chen,
was all he said. And even then, that took a great effort from the smaller man.
Nice to meet you, Chen. Too bad it's under these circumstances, but you know what? We'll be behind the lieutenant the whole way. Isn't that right, Sir Magnificent?
Riskin tried for a lopsided smile, but only achieved a half-sneer with contempt on top.
1 minute!
What made the bellow so odd was that there was only Riskin and Chen. No one else was nearby. They couldn't hear any other people yelling. Riskin wondered how many IMs were left. He couldn't remember seeing more than a handful at any one time in any one place. The only officer he remembered was the lieutenant.
How many total are in this human wave, Your Sirness?
Riskin asked suddenly.
All of them! Every swinging dick, Lance Corporal! Now, fix bayonets!
The lieutenant moved to the edge of the trench and cupped his hands as if to give them a boost up. He noted that they didn't have bayonets, but the lieutenant seemed to be in a different place, at a different time.
Oh, hell no,
Riskin answered, stepping up beside the lieutenant and cupping his hands.
You can pull us up once you're on top, Riskin suggested.
The lieutenant unholstered his pistol and nodded.
You know, if you don't come, I'll shoot you.
He smiled at the two men and looked at his watch, breathing heavily and grinning.
I think the order has been rescinded,
Akchul said and relaxed.
Wow, that was a close one. Smoke if you are having them, eh, Marpool?
You get up that wall, dickface. 10, 9.
The Marpool counted down, holding his shock stick at the ready. Akchul weighed his imminent death versus an extended period of pain before dying. He didn't like his options.
1!
The third-level Marpool screeched in a click and a whistle. Akchul had no idea where he found the courage, but he hit the two steps carved into the mud wall, popping out of the trench and into the open. He stood there, dumbfounded, but was bumped out of the way as the Marpool climbed up behind him. Side by side they stood, two Bazarians. 100 yards away, a human popped out of his trench, but he wasn't looking their way.
Well?
The Marpool demanded.
Well, what?
Akchul wondered.
Shoot him! Shoot the enemy, dickface!
The junior officer howled, stamping one foot in the mud. Akchul looked at it, curious that there was mud up in no man's land, too. He figured all the water made its way into his trench. He couldn't imagine that there was any remaining to make mud elsewhere. Maybe the planet wasn't a rock, but one big mud ball. He looked at the terrain, certain that no argument could convince him otherwise.
Fire!
The officer yelled.
Right,
Akchul said, thinking about the mud and that this would all be over soon. The winner could go home. He called out,
Time to win, your preeminent supremeness!
Akchul took aim with his old slug thrower and pulled the trigger. Nothing. The Marpool was not pleased and jammed the shock stick against the enlisted man's leg. Akchul screamed in pain until his whole body convulsed and he dropped his weapon. It slid in the mud and back into the trench. The third-level Marpool released the button and Akchul doubled over.
I shall recover my weapon, sir,
he said without any derision. He resigned himself to the fact that he would die in pain. He hated the humans for being here with him. He hated the council for sending him to the godforsaken place. But he hated the Marpool most of all.
No, you'll fight them hand to hand. Look at their frail pink flesh. You'll rend them into tiny pieces. Now forward, ho!
Akchul walked ahead as if carrying the casket to his funeral. The perceived weight on his shoulders was equally great. Riskin had every intention of running as soon as the lieutenant was out of the trench, but when Riskin threw him forward, the officer twisted in mid-air like a spider monkey and landed, aiming his pistol at Riskin's astonished face. With a sigh of reservation, he reached up, and the lieutenant pulled him to the top. They both leaned back down and grabbed Chen's outstretched arms. Besides holding his hands in the air, the private was incapable of helping. They dragged him up the mud wall and deposited him face first in the mud. He lay there, weaponless. His slug thrower was still in the trench.
"You first, Private," the lieutenant growled. "If you can't shoot, then you can be our human shield. Now move! Lance Corporal, rifle up!"
Riskin whirled through 180 degrees. The lieutenant ducked to avoid getting brained by the weapon's barrel as it flashed past.
"Watch it!"
the lieutenant yelled, focusing all his attention on the two junior enlisted and none of it on the enemy. Riskin had never had any respect for him before, but that clinched it. He decided that he had to kill the man. He looked across no man's land to see who was watching. As far as the eye could see, horizon to horizon, he saw no more than 10 interstellar marines. Most were singles, by themselves in the middle of nowhere. The story was the same on the other side. The Bazarians had an equal number.
"You have got to be kidding me. Are we it? We're all that's left?"
Riskin glared at the lieutenant.
"How in the hell did I get so unlucky to be stuck here and with an idiot like you?"
"No one ever leaves,"
the lieutenant whispered as if talking to himself. Akchul shuffled toward the humans. The Marpul stayed behind him, hiding, but carrying his shock stick and ready to inflict pain should Akchul try to run.
"I have no weapon, dickface. Maybe you give me your stick? Or better, why don't you go first?"
Akchul said, continuing to slop through the mud. His answer was the stick jammed into his leg, followed by a short burst of voltage. Akchul spasmed and fell. Pain and death were becoming one and the same. As he lay there, he saw the few bodies walking across no man's land. The final push? It looked like wayward souls stumbling through the mist of life. The third-level Marpul screamed at Akchul to get up and keep walking. Pain and death. He had no incentive to rise. The Marpul stabbed the stick against the prostrate Bazarian's leg and pressed the button, holding it to inflict the maximum punishment.
"Shoot them!"
the lieutenant screamed frantically. Chen dropped to his knees and covered his ears. He pinched his eyes closed and rocked himself. Lance Corporal Riskin Devereaux raised his slug thrower and took aim.
"If we win, I get to go home," he thought as he zeroed in on the one spiker jamming some stick into a second one lying on the ground. "They don't want to be here any more than I do," he thought. "But if we win, I get to go home. Losing is dying."
"No one ever leaves," the lieutenant said. "What the hell?"
"What did you mean by that?"
Riskin asked, lowering his slug thrower, which enraged the lieutenant.
"What did you mean when you said no one ever leaves?"
The young officer aimed his pistol at Riskin's face.
"What I meant isn't for the likes of you. Now raise your weapon, Marine, and get back into this battle. For the glory of the IM and a battle banner for the longest battle ever fought in all the interstellar wars, we must win!"
The whites of the lieutenant's eyes showed as his mouth hung open and he panted like an animal. His pistol shook as his knuckles whitened from his frantically tight grip. Riskin raised his slug thrower's barrel and aimed at the Bazarian, cajoling the one in the mud. "Sight picture, sight alignment." He focused on the front sight post, positioning the slightly fuzzy silhouette of the spiker in the middle of the rear sight aperture. When everything was aligned, he exhaled and gently squeezed the trigger. The weapon barked and the trigger froze to the rear. It cycled uncontrollably like a machine gun, making the barrel jump. The first round hit the Bazarian center mass in the center of its chest. As the barrel jumped, the impact climbed. The next round hit the enemy in the throat, and the last impact blew a hole through its head. The weapon jumped out of Riskin's hands as it continued to fire. The lieutenant was too slow diving out of the way, and the last round from the magazine tore through the lieutenant's head. The slug thrower splashed into the mud beside Chen, followed closely by the lieutenant, who toppled over backward. Riskin stood, eyes wide with shock at what had happened. He barely breathed. He'd killed his lieutenant.
"But it was an accident," he tried to reason.
Chen mumbled and whined.
Shut up, Chen!
Riskin yelled. Then realized his mistake. Chen hadn't done anything wrong. The man was terrified. Riskin thought he should have felt worse, but he seemed oddly relieved. He felt free for the first time in a long time. He was out from under someone else's boot, even if only for a short while.
It's okay, Chen. Stand up and let's go. There's no one left to report anything, no one left who knows anything.
Riskin looked around and saw a few figures here or there, but wasn't sure if they were human or Bazarian. The enemy closest to him was picking himself up out of the mud. Akchul heard the sound at the same time he saw the slugs impact the third-level Marpool. The officer was close, and Akchul simply laid there and watched as the Bazarian was torn apart. The dead body flopped like a wet rag, splashing into the mud. The enlisted Bazarian crabbed backward, away from his dead officer. He thought about running for his trench, but if he didn't stand, then maybe they would think him dead? He remained where he was, but watched the humans closely. Where once there had been three, only one remained standing. Of the other two, one knelt, and the last looked as dead as the Marpool. One helped the other to his feet, then they turned and walked back to their trench. When they reached it, they stood there, motionless for an interminable amount of time. He saw his opportunity to return unseen to his own trench. Riskin and Chen stood at the top of the wall, looking down at a heavy, yellow gas. It rose chest-high within, and that was if one knew where the high points were.
"Damn the lieutenant," Riskin said softly,
then turned back to the officer's body and screamed,
"Damn you!"
Chen was coming back to himself, having raced through four of the five stages of grief, from denial to anger, bargaining, and depression. He was ready to accept his depression as the final state of his life.
"What if we surrender?" Chen asked.
As a private in the IM, he'd never had to think for himself. Someone else always told him what to do. He needed that in his life. Riskin Devereaux was the opposite. He despised people telling him what to do. Which was how he ended up as a Marine, to show his father that he couldn't tell Riskin what to do. Riskin hadn't appreciated how much freedom he'd had when he lived at home. The irony wasn't lost on him. The years of being ordered around by an idiot like the lieutenant had convinced him how smart and wise his father was, and how young and stupid Riskin had been.
"Now I'm going to die for it, killed by my own people because everyone wants this little planet and this little war to go away."
"I wonder," Riskin started to say. "Come on, Chen, let's see if I'm right."
He turned Chen around, and they started walking toward the muddy Bazarian, who was looking at his trench the same way they'd just looked at theirs.
"You speak Chinese, Chen?" Riskin asked.
"What do you think?"
the private replied sarcastically, trying hard not to look at the lieutenant's exploded head as they walked past. He failed miserably, and he couldn't keep his eyes off it.
"I'll tell that Bazarian not to go into the trench. It's poison," Riskin said.
Chen translated the phrases in milliseconds in his head and then spoke Mandarin Chinese in a normal tone of voice.
"Come on, Chen, everyone knows that spikers don't have ears. You gotta really belt it out."
Riskin threw up his hands in hopeful encouragement.
"You're kidding, right?"
Chen asked.
"You ask a lot of questions, Private," Riskin sneered. "Why would I kid about something like poison and death?"
"If they don't have ears, why would yelling make any difference?"
Chen explained, eyebrows raised.
"Damn straight. Maybe he can read lips," Riskin suggested, then laughed heartily.
The Bazarians didn't have lips. Riskin and Chen kept walking across no man's land. Akchul looked at the green gas in the trench. He could smell it. Death. He thought he heard someone tell him not to go into the trench, but it was in the human Chinese language. He knew the voice spoke the truth, although the truth sounded strange, no matter which language it was communicated in.
"Hate humans," Akchul said.
He looked back at the dead body of the Marpool.
"Hate Marpool more. Sorry, your cerebral supremeness, in that I didn't recognize your superiority sooner and race across the wasteland with reckless abandon to dispatch your enemies.
He saluted haphazardly, then swaggered to the body, picked up the stick, and jabbed it against the leg. When he depressed the button, the Marpole's body jumped, but the stick shorted out, sending electricity through the water and into Actual's foot. He dropped the stick and jumped around on one leg, feeling like a moron for shocking himself. The humans stopped on the other side of the Marpole and stood there watching Actual's antics. He stopped hopping and stood still, returning the human's gaze.
"Don't go into your trench, the gas is death,"
the Bazarian told them in the sing-song language of diplomacy. The creature was the same size as the two marines, but to Riskin, the Bazarian looked like a cross between a bumblebee and a wasp. When it spoke Chinese, Riskin was relieved, but still couldn't understand the creature. Chen nodded and replied. Riskin slapped the shorter man on the arm. Chen remembered that the other marine didn't speak his language.
"He said not to go into the trenches."
"We know that," Riskin said.
"That's what I told him."
Chen looked oddly at the lance corporal. "So what the hell do we do now?" Riskin asked. Chen translated the question for the Bazarian.
"Damn it, I was asking you, not him," Riskin clarified.
Chen shrugged.
"Actual,"
the Bazarian said, pointing to himself with one spindly arm.
"Riskin,"
Chen said, pointing to the lance corporal. He said it twice and then pointed to himself.
"Chen."
"Who was that?" Riskin asked, leaning toward the Bazarian that he himself had killed.
"The Marpole, an officer, a bad officer,"
Actual said, and Chen interpreted for Riskin.
"Our officer too, bad and dead," Riskin said succinctly.
"What do we do now?"
Actual wondered.
"Find a way off this godforsaken mudball," Riskin exclaimed.
Chen smiled before telling Actual what the lance corporal had said. The Bazarian bobbed excitedly.
"Like humans," he said.
The clicks and whistles of the Bazarian language were lost on his new companions.
Broken One by Josie Russell. "Dear son, now that I'm gone, you're going to hear a lot about who I was and who your mother should have been. Try not to get too defensive. Much of that is probably true." The jarring thud of an 800-ton, long-range plasma missile shook the ship, and all Rhys could think of was that stupid letter. One of the king's advisors, Carnat, had slipped it into his hand as he'd walked to his ship at the beginning of this battle, and he'd gotten through the first confusing page before the fire had begun to fall hard. Even as he spun to return the fire, the elegant handwriting, the self-deprecating humor of the writer, the fragility of the fiber paper, skidded through his head. His primary hands, with their strange extra digits, worked the pitch of the cannon, while the three fingers of his secondary hands, on the ends of short, thin arms that jutted out just below the bend of his elbows, streaked across the buttons on the upper dash, aiming, firing again. He kept the extra fingers out of the way expertly, just as he had practiced, tucking them in toward his palms. He had to in order to keep up the speed and accuracy with which he was firing. He was good at manning a fighter pod. He always had been. Better, they said, than anyone in the last century. He knew what they were saying when they said that. Better than anyone since your father. It had been over 100 Retellian years since his father manned just such a ship. Another missile jolted Reese's ship, the Luma. His teeth knocked together. He spun the turret and finished off the attacking craft. The turret smelled hot and sharp. Reese checked the heat readouts.
"Let's get the aft guns vented,"
he called to Natu, the assistant engineer assigned to him. It was just the two of them in here, much to the engineer's dismay. Natu scowled up at him.
"Aft guns aren't due for venting."
Reese bit back a curse. Arguing would just waste time and focus.
"They need it done now. I'm firing fast and hot up here, and if we let them go too long, we're going to lose them."
He had to keep them online. Besides the risk of a plasma ignition,
The only other defense he had on the aft half of the ship was a single heavy charge, and he needed to save it. He let the thought of being in the middle of this battle without any aft guns sink in for a long moment. Another barrage rocked the ship, adding urgency to the conversation. Natu began swiping his control pad. Rhys felt the momentary breathlessness as the venting changed the pressure in the cabin slightly. Natu didn't notice, and Rhys tried not to show his discomfort, holding his breath and gulping once the atmosphere normalized again. Rhys couldn't afford time to discuss his physiological abnormalities just now, and he hoped Natu wasn't watching. He looked at the readouts. 3 enemy ships left. A light attacker, a stinger, and a pinwheel. A globe studded with firing ports that made shooting from any direction easy. 3 Morrow ships versus the Luma and the Trevet, the ship where his cousin stood on the deck. That was all that was left of the Retellian fleet, all that was left of the whole Retellian Empire, besides the children and caregivers back on the planet. Once these 2 ships were gone, nothing would stop the Morrow from dropping their burning rain on Rhys's home planet and terraforming it for their own use. The fleet had been strong, but the Morrow were stronger, and they knew things. They knew, it seemed, the Retell's every weakness. They knew of the breathing port behind the left ear on every male, and they used that knowledge in hand-to-hand combat. They knew that zinc was fatal to infant Retell. They knew that there was a taboo against speaking the name of the Retellian son. Even now, as it flitted like a bird across Rhys's mind, Cythia, he felt a little guilty. How they had gathered this much intel, no one in the leadership knew. It was more than a leak. It was as if they had somehow gotten into the minds and culture of the Retell, and that had given the Morrow a distinct battle advantage. The 3 ships were arcing wide. They'd form a tripoint and close in, Rhys knew. He'd seen it before. He glanced at the live feed from the Trevet. Uom, his cousin, leaned forward in his command chair, unmasked fear on his face. He was the sovereign leader of the Retell, the head of state and the military. But Uom had never been in battle, and the Trevet was not a warship. It was a royal transport, meant to get him and his family away from Retell before the Morrow could get to them. Though his defense squad was firing valiantly, this attack would be the end of the monarchy, and effectively, the end of the Retell. The end of the monarchy. That phrase came from the letter, too. They said your mother would bring about the end of the monarchy, but it went on without her, which goes to show that things aren't always as bad as they seem. There is always a way to do the right thing. The right thing here was simple. And Rhys didn't hesitate. 3 attackers. Priority target, the light attack ship. In any other instance it would have been the pinwheel, but Rhys had been watching, and by the looks of the red glow under its skin, its guns were overheating too. The light attack ship was already firing on the Trevet, and Rhys used the thrusters to flip the Luma and push it between the 2. He was firing before he righted, and the pulses rocked the enemy craft. Rhys defied his academy training by avoiding the urge to set up a firing position. If the Morrow knew from which direction they could expect fire, they'd maneuver to keep their best shields toward him. Every visible panel of the LAS was heavily shielded, but Rhys had faced over 30 light attack ships in the last few weeks, and he'd discovered something. A panel, just between the aft tracking ports of the enemy craft, that crumpled like paper under heavy fire. This is what he'd been saving that last charge for. He kept barrel-rolling the Luma, guns trained on the LAS, streaming pulses. He had to draw their attention, needed the Morrow to stabilize their own attack position toward him. He knew it was working when the dazzling little ship turned its attack from the Trevet and onto him. Strafing it with fire, he spun the Luma up and over the Morrow ship's position and brought it to a jarring halt just aft and starboard of the craft. This was the moment. His secondary hands hit the fire button and the heavy charge burst from the belly of the Luma, driving straight and silent toward the Morrow ship. They detected it, tried to spin, but were too late. The charge hit the top edge of the panel and the ship keened off, internal explosions flashing alongside the haphazard stream of plasma missiles, tumbling from the firing ports and drifting into the blackness around them. Rhys turned his attention back to the remaining ships. As he'd predicted, they'd turned their fire on him when he engaged the light craft, and it was only now, in the absence of its constant barrage, that he noticed they'd been firing too. The pinwheel's charges weren't hitting, though, its elevated temperature playing havoc, he supposed, with their guidance systems. But the double barrels of the third ship, the Stinger, were sending out long-range, high-efficiency pulses that were finding their marks more often than he'd realized. The Luma's control board lit up with damage reports. The outer hull was beginning to falter. His was the only ship in the fleet with that extra protection. It was mostly meant to keep the vast, sucking emptiness of deep space at bay, but it also helped in moments like this, when they were under fire. The presence of the extra hull annoyed Natu, mostly because it added a layer of complexity to his engineering duties, and Rhys was tempted for a nanosecond to say something about how the engineer should appreciate it. Without heavy charges, he didn't know how to take down a Stinger. Long and lean, the ship cut toward him like a smooth-edged blade. Its pulses didn't rock the ship like the missiles had done. Instead, each brought a prolonged shiver that ran through the metal and lit up the readout screens. Each vibration locked Rhys's body with a fleeting shock, a buzz that froze his 16 fingers useless above the controls. The closer the Stinger got, the more intense the brief fits of paralysis became.
"Do something!"
Natu's voice was strangled. He was suffering more from the pulses than Rhys.
"On it,"
Rhys said, trying to sound cheerful. His mind scoured the possibilities. Heavy charges were gone. Plasma missiles were likely too slow to reach the Stinger before it reached him. Rhys had never faced a Stinger without a battleship backup before, and he was seeing why the pod-on Stinger strategy wasn't taught at the Academy, because there was no chance for the pod. But he'd always been good at seeing things no one else saw. And in the long, breathless moment of the next shockwave, Rhys saw what he needed to do. Slowly, as his body thawed, he rotated the ship.
"Yes!"
Natu cried from below.
"Let's get out of here!"
Rhys didn't stop to explain they weren't retreating. To do so was to leave the Trevet as good as helpless. Though it still had a chance against the crippled pinwheel, the Stinger would destroy the smaller ship. He aimed his aft guns, an apology to Natu on the edge of his mind, and started to fire. The controls were designed to force a pause between the pulses, allowing a slight cooling of the firing system so it would last in a battle. But Rhys didn't need it to last. He needed heat, and he needed it now. So he used his extra fingers, the little ones on the edges of his primary hands, the ones nobody else had, to do what he'd spent so much time in the Academy training himself not to do. The extra reach allowed him to hit the firing button simultaneously, instead of alternating as the system was designed to do. The pulses became a stream, and he aimed them at the oncoming assault from the Stinger.
"We're overheating!"
Rhys wished he hadn't vented the aft guns. This had made this process just that much longer, and he had no seconds to spare.
"Emergency suits, Natu,"
Rhys said, using his knee to bump his own ES activation button. A specially designed suit unfolded around him.
"No, Rhys,"
Natu said.
"No, stop this!"
"It's time for an exit strategy,"
Rhys said, trying to keep his voice even. Another shock thrummed through the ship, and his fingers clenched hard on the panel, depressing the firing buttons for that long frozen moment. A bitter smell filled the ship. The heat was reaching a critical point. He hoped it would be quick, that the heat would fry them fast so they wouldn't suffer too long. He considered removing the suit, but there was no time now. Brilliant light shot through every crevice of the Luma, emanating from the aft cannons as the plasma reached the flashpoint and ignited in the barrel.
"Please,"
Rhys heard himself say. The final pulse streaked forward, carrying its intense energy directly to the thousands of invisible plasma trails the Stinger's pulses had left behind.
Like rails of fire, they lit up, igniting and racing each other back where they'd come from. The Morrow ship's cannons. The two ships erupted at the same time, and Rhys had one last fleeting glimpse of the Stinger shattering apart as his own ship ruptured and he was ejected. It was the last thing Rhys saw as he tumbled into darkness. It wasn't my idea to send you away. The words of the letter came to Rhys through the darkness. He strained to hear Natu, to see if he was okay, but there was only silence, save for his father's voice in his head, speaking those haunting phrases. Father sounded just as he had that morning so long ago, when Rhys had been loaded into a cab ship and delivered like a package to the Juvenile Academy. I would have stayed with you, and with her, forever. But there was no place for our family in their world, no place that we could picnic or hold hands or watch a sunrise without people staring. After she died... The words still jolted Rhys. He hated them. The royals just didn't know what to do with you and I. They would have kept you locked away, Rhys, hidden, if I hadn't agreed to go. I'll always be grateful that they allowed you into the academy. You don't know it, but your fate would have been much worse if they'd chosen to turn you out. And now I hear you're an ace pilot. Better, I understand, than I was. That doesn't surprise me. You were born better. I know what you've heard about your mother, that she let the Retellian Empire down, that she abandoned her subjects. But that's not true. You should know that. Did she abdicate? Yes, she did. She gave up her throne and her title. An abdication means a lot of things. It means that instead of being the most respected, revered leader, you become the most berated, least trusted suspect of your country. It means you leave your home, and you're always on the edge of every family gathering. You're not allowed to have an opinion on how your brother is managing the empire, though everyone else has one, because you had the chance to do it your way, and you threw it away. And if you threw it away to marry someone completely unsuitable to rule with you, then it's even worse. But that's one thing you need to know, my son. And here Reza's mind also conjured his father's face, the crinkling eyes, the upturned mouth, hideous, like his own. Your mother didn't give up her throne for me. The first time he'd read the letter was the first time Rhys had ever heard that. All the sneering and jeering from the others at the academy, all the official documents he'd seen, all the broadcast interviews, had said that his mother had left her throne because she was in love with his father, and no one would ever accept his father as a member of the royal family. So, if she hadn't abdicated to be with his father, what had made her leave the throne? What had convinced her to turn her back on her subjects? And why did the letter argue that she hadn't actually turned her back on them after all? Rhys was dimly aware of voices. He listened again for Natu, but heard only strange tones and unfamiliar speakers. He feared space had claimed his engineer. Rhys ran through the last moments of the battle. Could he have done more, done better? The weight of Natu's loss shook him. He couldn't breathe properly. It was as if his lungs weren't having to work as hard as usual. They felt light and floppy, his mind giddy with extra air. His suit must be malfunctioning. He pushed a hand toward his mouth to check for obstructions, but found nothing there. He tried to force his heavy eyes open, but a hand to his forehead found them wrapped in gauze. Rhys wanted to tear it off, but he was afraid. That last bright light, had it damaged them? All he could think was that he hadn't read the second page of the letter yet. His father had more to tell him. What if he could never read it? He lay very still and ran a hand down his chest. He wasn't wearing his protective gear, just his flight uniform. The letter made a crinkling sound in his pocket. He realized he wasn't floating in deep space anymore. He was lying on his side on what felt like a cold floor. The back of his left shoulder seared with pain from a flash burn. Reaching out, he felt thick metal slats all around him. He was in a cage. More voices. He couldn't understand them. They were speaking a different language, and their tones, Rhys was sure, sounded nothing like Retellian speech. He crawled to the edge of his cell and pressed his secondary fingers between the slats. The bars were long and thin. He began to probe, hoping to find a lock to release. A loud exclamation told Reese that he'd been seen. He pulled his hand back into the cage. There was a strange squeeing and the sound of static before familiar words began to flow in around him.
"That better? Can you understand me?"
His captor was using a translation wedge. Reese recognized the artificial voice. Strange words, then a stream of retellion.
"Where am I?"
he asked, and the wedge garbled out his question to its owner.
"You are on a research ship. We picked you up in open space. You were lucky we were trawling."
Even in retellion, the word was unfamiliar.
"Trawling?" "Right. Scraping space for interesting particles, and then we found you." "What's wrong with the air?" "Nothing. This is what you were meant to breathe. Your suit seemed maladjusted for your needs. Have you always breathed that mixture?" "Of course, that's what we breathe on my planet." "Interesting,"
the voice said.
"You'll likely find this a bit easier."
"Why can't I see?"
"Your eyes are badly burned. That's why we're keeping you out of the light, too." "In a cage?" "Well, that's for our safety. We weren't sure exactly what..." "What I am." "Right." "You won't win any awards for that observation."
There was a long pause, as if the researcher didn't know how to respond.
"I'm only joking,"
Reese said.
"I'm a bit of an anomaly where I come from, too." "Retell?"
"Yes."
The researcher made a sound, but the translator didn't speak. The noise it made sounded like surprise.
"Who are you?" "I'm Dr. Kataris. I tended to your wounds." "Then locked me up?" "Yes."
There was acknowledgement in the doctor's voice, a taking of responsibility. Reese appreciated that.
"Who do you work for? Whose ship is this?" "We are from Cause, the Consortium of Species. Our mission..." "I know your mission. Collect specimens, study them. It's important to know all we can about various species." "Why? What do you do with that information?"
There was a long pause after the translator finished relating his question. The researcher, it seemed, had walked away. But another series of tones and static came from Reese's left. Another translator, this one a little slower, was activated. "They won't answer the hard questions. Believe me, I've asked." The voice was light and her language complex. "They keep saying they'll let us out, but I haven't seen any evidence that they mean it."
"Who are you?"
"Another prisoner," she said. "The only other prisoner right now, though it looks like they are set up for a lot more." There was a little pause before she added, almost as an afterthought, "They call me Delta."
"Where did you come from?"
"They brought me from a refinery over in the Baron Quadrant. I was navigating a fuel vessel they hired to come out and fill them up." Her voice got quiet. "I don't know why they wanted me. There were a lot more interesting species on the ship. At first I thought they needed a navigator, but they brought me in here, and I haven't left the room since."
"How long?"
Reese asked. "Months, I guess. It's hard to tell now."
"Has it been bad?"
There was a long pause before she spoke. "Some of it." Reese wouldn't ask her any more about that. He didn't need to. He could hear her pain. He started to ask what she was, then hesitated and changed his mind.
"Can you see me?"
he asked instead. "A little. There's just little slits between us, but I can see a bit of you." This cheered Reese. He wondered if he should take off his bandages. How badly burned was he? He already felt the cooling sensation of his body's natural healing secretion sliding over the wound on his shoulder. His eyes should be repairing soon as well.
"I have to get out of here,"
he said.
"I have to get back to my planet."
He tried not to think about the fact that it was left completely vulnerable now. "What are you?" the other inmate asked.
I've never seen hands like these. He felt her fingers on his and realized that he had unconsciously reached toward her. His slim secondary hand was through the slats and surrounded by her own warm hands. And in that moment of vulnerability, blind and imprisoned, Reese told the truth he had never spoken aloud before.
I don't know what I am.
She didn't gasp as he'd expected, didn't question. Just continued stroking his fingers in silence as more words poured out of him.
My mother was the queen of the Ritel. She was a perfect example of her race. But she abdicated her throne abruptly and married my father.
A long pause hung between them. Into the gap tumbled all of Reese's memories, the brief glimpses of his father, the torment he endured at school when they talked about what he could possibly be. The words trickled out, every breath painful as he went on.
They called my father the Broken One,
he said, listening to the echo of it through the translator. It sounded no better in her language.
He was weak, could barely stand, couldn't breathe properly. His body was strange and lacking. His face was misshapen. The Ritel couldn't believe that their beautiful queen could love him.
Though Reese had never admitted it, he couldn't believe that his mother had loved his father either. As he admitted this to himself, the old shame rose again in his throat. He knew better than any of them what weaknesses his father had passed on to him. She mumbled. The translator said, in his language, "The Broken One." He started to pull back his hand, but she held fast, stopping him, holding tight to his three fingers. "Everybody's broken," she said softly. "Somehow." If he hadn't heard the scrape of the door, if he hadn't felt the shift in the pressure of the ship, he would never have awoken. But Reese had spent his youth sleeping lightly, waiting for someone to pull him out of bed or throw something at him as he slept. He was used to waking quickly. He heard rough breathing and something falling. It sounded like a struggle.
"Delta," he whispered. "Are you there? I need your eyes."
Only silence answered him. The realization took his breath away. It was her he could hear struggling. Reese pulled himself onto his knees, tearing the bandages from his eyes. There was pain, but it was lost in his panic as he blinked, trying to see through the slats. He was in a lab. Data readouts and glass beakers stood on stark black counters. Empty cages like his own lined the walls. The struggle was over. Delta's cage was open, the slats of its door limiting his view of the right side of the room. A hulking creature stood at a counter just on the edge of Reese's line of vision. It was hairless, with smooth skin pinched into ridges all over its head and exposed hands. It was wearing a white lab coat, and its skin shone silvery green in the artificial light. Delta was there. Reese couldn't see her, but he could hear the pained noises she was making. The creature was reaching inside a glass cabinet, extracting vials. Reese didn't know what the creature would do with them, but he had to get out. He had to help her. Ignoring his burning eyes, he thrust his secondary hand through the slats again, running his slim fingers along the outside of the cell until he found the locking mechanism. He found it easy to manipulate, and the cage door swung open. Reese tumbled out, dropping to the floor and springing up just as the creature turned toward him. Its eyes were flat and rimmed, like two wheels sunken into its face. Its mouth was small and active, accounting for the range of sounds he'd heard earlier. Reese was ready to strike, but as the creature turned, Reese's body involuntarily slowed. It was as if a sopping blanket had been draped around him. The creature's face, wide and ridged, stared at him a moment. "Defense mechanism," Reese thought. "It's emitting a tone that's disrupting the signals in my nervous system." He'd learned about many defenses, natural and artificial, at the academy. Only now he couldn't think what to do about it. The creature was injecting Delta. Reese could see the tips of her boots, twitching on the table. He tried harder to reach her, to make his limbs move. Her translation wedge sprung to life, and he heard her voice, soft, and its artificial one, much louder. "Let me go!" The creature was wearing a wedge, too, and its voice, which sounded like grinding rocks, came through as,
"I told you, I'm here to help. Just try to relax."
Breeze recognized the voice. Kataris. "Leave me alone." Her voice was weak. "They already injected me today."
"I know. That's why I'm here. This will reverse the effects of the earlier injections."
"Why would you do that?" Her voice dripped bitterness. "So you can begin a new series of experiments." Rhys saw, but couldn't believe, a slump in the doctor's shoulders. He read it as remorse.
"You'll go through no more experiments if I can help it."
"So you're here to kill me?" Rhys saw that her twitching had slowed. Was she dying? He pushed harder against the weight on him, yet still he couldn't move. Kataris shook his head.
"I'm not a part of the cause. Not really. I work for another agency that has long suspected the cause is crossing lines that it shouldn't. I've been embedded here for years, gathering intel on their activities."
"You're a spy?"
"More or less."
"Who do you work for?" Delta asked.
"That's not something I can say right now."
"Why tell me at all, then?"
"Because I'm leaving. I'm leaving, and I want to free you before I go. You've suffered enough. And you..."
He glanced over at Rhys.
"You will, too, if I leave you here."
Kataris turned back to Delta. Rhys wished he could see more of her to confirm that she was all right.
"You should start feeling stronger any time now,"
Kataris said. Rhys heard more strength in Delta's voice as she spoke.
I am.
She sounded surprised.
"Listen, I know it's going to be hard to trust me, but if you don't and we get caught, the cost will kill us all very quickly."
The tone in the doctor's voice, the grave concern, implied he'd just spoken an absolute truth.
"Why?"
She stopped.
"Why would you help us?"
Kataris didn't speak immediately. Instead, he slowly screwed the top back on the vial, slowly put it back in the cabinet, and slowly disposed of the syringe. Then he spoke, and his grinding voice was weary.
"I've been on this vessel a long time. Years. I've seen so much. Done so much. It's time I start making amends for everything I've been involved in. I'm starting with you two."
Delta seemed to accept that.
"Let me sit up," she said.
"Not until you're steady."
"I am." Her voice was stronger. "I am now. Your antidote, or whatever it was, worked fine. I'm steady."
She held up a hand, and Rhys saw it reach triumphantly into the air, appearing over the beast's left shoulder. Later he would remember that moment in time as if he were frozen inside a glacier. He still couldn't move properly, and the sight of that hand, her hand, took away his energy to fight whatever it was that weighed him down. 5 fingers, a little strange extra one on each hand, just like his own primary hands. And as she sat up, her eyes, her face, they were so familiar. Only her secondary arms were missing and her knees lacked the pivots his had. They seemed only to bend in a single direction. Could she be a mutant Rittel too, broken like him and his father? But there was no time to ask. Dr. Kataris turned to him again and spoke.
"I'm sorry I had to sedate you, but we haven't any time. We've arrived at Morrow, and if we're getting off this ship, we need to do it now."
Rhys blinked. One word was echoing in his mind.
"Morrow? Why are we at Morrow?" "The COS has been updating them with the results of their experiments for some time now. I suspect they're here to reveal the secrets of more species."
"The COS? Feeding information to the Morrow? That must have been how they'd gotten so much knowledge of the Rittel." It made a disgusting sort of sense.
"But why?" "Because the COS has big plans,"
Kataris said.
"They're angling to destroy the monarchies and unite the different races under their own rule. I've been working with these monsters for a long time. I can see they're planning on making a move soon. They've been using the Morrow to fight their battles, and the Morrow are nearly used up, so the time is coming for the Kos to try to take power. The Morrow are nearly used up?
Rhys said, trying to understand what that meant.
They've battled so many species and come out victorious, though sometimes by very narrow margins. They have very few defenses left, few ships, few soldiers. There's not even a defensive contingent on the planet today.
The doctor nodded.
That's why I'm getting off here. An escape from Morrow is much less complicated than one from other ports.
He put an arm out to support Delta as she sat on the edge of the counter. Kataris was still talking, his translator grumbling along behind his own voice.
Destroying the Morrow was all part of the Kos plan, of course. The Morrow themselves were far too powerful for the Kos to challenge when they started this. The Kos have promised the Morrow special leadership once the new rule is established, and paid them well for each monarchy they toppled. The Kos let the Morrow wear themselves out, conquering everyone else. Victory always comes at a price, you know.
A shudder shook the ship. They had landed. The thought that he was on the planet that had pushed the Ratel to the brink of extinction turned like a snake in Reese's stomach.
Well, come on,
Katara said.
If you're coming. Here, help her. We need to go quickly.
Just like that, Rhys could move again. Kataris had stopped the tone that interrupted his abilities, and he felt lighter now that the impeding waves were gone. The blanket had been lifted free. Delta seemed to share his newfound freedom, and he realized the doctor had been repressing her struggles with the same mechanism. Rhys felt shy as he slid an arm set around her for support and followed the doctor out of the lab. The hallways were darkened, and whatever terrors Rhys had imagined were absent for the time being. The air outside the lab was slightly different, heavier somehow, and Rhys felt more confident as his lungs increased their effort. This is how he was accustomed to breathing. But Delta had begun to gasp. Without a word, Kataris reached into his pocket and held out two small devices on the open palm of a hand, more delicate than Rhys expected. Delta took one and expertly adjusted it around her nose. Immediately, she began to breathe easier. Kataris offered the other to Rhys, but he shook his head.
I'm fine,
he said.
Take it anyway,
Kataris shrugged.
I'm not likely to need it.
He tapped two gills on his neck as Rhys slipped the device into his pocket.
Follow me.
The doctor gestured forward, and they made their way deeper into the ship. As they walked, Rhys realized he still had a bit of gauze clinging to his right temple. Delta noticed it too. She reached up and removed it with ease. Her misshapen hand was warm against his skin, and he smiled his thanks to her. Kataris led them into a small anteroom with a door at the other end. Though the symbols on the door were unreadable to Rhys, the stench told him exactly where it led. He wasn't surprised when it opened onto a garbage bay, piled with the detritus of the ship's long weeks in space. Automated scoops were pulling through the room in predictable patterns. They pushed the piles out of garbage ports in the side of the ship, dropping their loads into carts on the hangar floor. The carts took the loads and dumped them into an incinerator, which filled the hangar with a thick, rancid smell. They watched a moment until they could gauge the timing of the next scoop, then slipped out through the port. Delta would sometimes stumble, and Rhys would catch her and carry her a few steps until she recovered her strength. The flight of stairs beside the garbage port was steep and narrow, and Rhys pulled Delta into his arm sets and carried her easily to the bottom. They left the big hangar and emerged into the sharp light of Morrow's sun. Rhys wondered briefly what its name was.
Where are we going?
He asked, setting Delta down and trying to keep up as Kataris took another in a long, complicated series of turns through what appeared to be an abandoned industrial complex.
There's an impound yard where a variety of captured ships are kept,
the doctor explained.
I've seen it on previous visits when the Kos were collecting specimens. The ships are captured by the Morrow, their drives are disabled, and they're parked out here, usually still populated. They just sit here waiting to be collected. It's like purgatory. They can't go home, can't escape. Conditions are usually awful. I've got the restoration key that will reactivate the drives.
Kataris held up a pale green cube which hung on a chain around his neck.
I think we can convince someone to fly us out of here in exchange for getting their drive back online. They're usually pretty desperate.
Reese followed him with more confidence. It didn't sound like a bad plan. Kataris was a useful companion, Reese realized, as they reached the gate to the impound yard. A few dozy guards met them, and the doctor gave a passable excuse. Reese assumed he explained the presence of the two multi-limbed aliens at his side. The guards' lack of interest in Kataris, the fact that their weapons remained holstered, told Reese they must be used to seeing the doctor on his errands. Reese wondered how many specimens he had collected from this yard. The guards waved them through as the gate opened. As the holding bay opened before them, Reese gasped. There, in the center of the impound yard, stood the Trevet. Reese ran, pulling Delta along with him. If Kataris was surprised at their sudden increase in speed, at the ship Reese picked to approach, or at the efficiency and familiarity with which Reese opened the port and climbed the ramp, he didn't show it. The Trevet, though, was no longer a royal transport. It was an empty gourd, hollow and dead inside. Where there had been royal parties and meetings for the heads of state, now there were blackened holes and rooms echoing with their own emptiness. Reese made his way to the bridge. Delta finally spoke. "You've been here?" Reese nodded.
"This was my mother's ship. After her abdication, it passed to my uncle, then on his death to his son, my cousin. I've been here for official ceremonies. The king bestows titles on all academy graduates. He should be here somewhere."
Reese searched desperately, his extra eyes scanning. The control room door was closed. Reese heard voices, familiar and clear, speaking his own language inside. He laid both his trembling left hands against the identification panel and the door disappeared into the floor. They stepped through. Inside, a ragged group of Retel stood swiftly, ready to defend themselves. But recognition dawned on their faces as he approached. The king's advisors, three old Retel whose faces were rugged as maps of the home world, took quick, reaching steps toward him. Carnot, the advisor who had given him his father's letter, was first. That moment when Reese had received the letter seemed, now, like a lifetime ago. Without warning, moving as one, the advisors knelt. Reese didn't understand what was happening. They had raised their arm sets, clasping both their primary and secondary hands above their bowed heads. One by one, the others knelt too. Reese heard them mummering two words, "Your Majesty." Reese stepped back.
"Wait, where is Uom? His sons? Where is the king?"
Carnot, the chief advisor, looked up and shook his head.
"Gone?"
Reese gulped. He felt Delta's hand on his shoulder. Her translator was gurgling in the background.
"All of them?" "All of them,"
the advisor said.
"We had no hope of a rescue, no hope that any of the royal family had survived."
Reese shook his head. He had never even been considered part of the royal family.
"You are the rightful heir to the throne,"
Carnot said,
"and you have returned to lead us."
In the back, on his knees, an engineer gave Reese a look filled with despair.
"If I may, we are stuck here. The Trevet's drive is disabled."
Reese waved a hand toward Dr. Kataris.